You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Rosalind English.
When the UK Parliament passed the Climate Change Act into law in 2008, it was the first time a country employed national framework legislation to impose economy-wide, legally binding, long-term emissions reduction targets upon itself in the interest of combating climate change. I have with me Dr. Thomas Mainser, former lecturer in energy law at the University of Dundee, and he's now just taken up a similar post at the University of Aberdeen. I also have David Hart QC, expert in environmental law, who will be discussing some of the practical implications of the climate change initiatives, both national and international. So, Thomas, starting with you, what is the Climate Change Act actually aiming to do?
Well, what the Act is aiming to do is, in effect, to sketch out a framework regime that is going to set a long-term policy direction for UK climate policy. And it endeavours to bring us up to the 2050 mark with a very important legally binding reduction obligation. And indeed, it looks beyond that mark. What it does in terms of its substance is at Section 1, Subsection 1, it lays down a very important milestone emissions reduction target for the UK as a whole. And that target sits at net zero. And it's construed in the legislation as a 100% greenhouse gas emissions reduction figure for 2050 based on 1990 emissions levels, which are described as baseline emissions levels in the legislation. And at Section 5.1a, it also sets down a very important reduction marker for this year, which is 2020, of course, and that's a 34% greenhouse gas emissions reduction marker for 2020 based on 1990 emissions levels. And so you have a trajectory there, a 34% reduction moving to a net zero or 100% reduction in our national internal emissions, economy-wide emissions for 2050. And around those two milestone markers, if you like, the Act sketches out a carbon budgeting regime, which is a fairly complicated, I suppose, carbon accounting mechanism to ensure that those reductions in emissions are driven across the economy.
And in fact, the Act's objectives and targets go beyond those required by the European Union, don't they?
Yes, that's right. And in fact, that perhaps may be comforting for people like myself and yourselves and others who are perhaps concerned with the potential impact of Brexit on our emissions reduction approaches to climate change. The Act is quite ambitious and pioneering. The goals it sets are quite stringent. And as you say, it goes beyond the baseline EU requirements, which, while the EU requirements don't currently go far enough to address climate change, they are, in the global context, fairly robust and pioneering. We have, for example, an important renewables directive, which sets reasonably stringent renewable energy standards. We've an important emissions trading scheme directive coming down from the EU that sets fairly stringent emissions trading standards that apply to certain sectors of the society, power generation, heavy industry, that sort of thing. We have an EU effort sharing decision that tries to engage effectively with emissions from agriculture and tricky sectors like that. So the EU has a robust regime in place. And this Act, in effect, endeavours to move beyond that baseline performance. And as is implied by your question, and is an important point, I think this isn't implementing legislation, it's not implementing EU law, it's what one might call an indigenous framework that interacts with EU law, but is a UK regime at heart. And that partly protects it from being buffeted over much by Brexit.
That, of course, is a comforting factor. But one of the issues that you touch upon in your article is that there may be a problem and that there's no actual sanction for breach of the Climate Change Act.
Yes, that's an interesting point. And it really takes us into the heart of the texture of this legislation. It's a very novel regime. It's dealing with a novel issue, which is climate change, which is a hard and tricky problem. And that, it was thought, would take a fairly novel legal framework. And when you look at the substance of this framework, you find interesting legal components that are very unusual, almost perhaps original. And to take some concrete examples as to how that novelty may raise some hard problems around sanctions and enforcement, well, we can return to those interesting milestone targets I mentioned. So our target for 2050 under Section 1.1, net zero reduction target, or in fact, we can go closer to home to the current year, the 34% target for 2020 under Section 5.1a. Who is responsible for securing that 34% target in law? It's a legally binding obligation. The duty is placed on the Secretary of State, and it's the Secretary of State for BEIS that really leads on emissions reduction and energy. So the Secretary of State has this legally binding obligation. Happily, we have reached that 34% target now, but let's imagine we hadn't. Well, what would one do from a lawyerly perspective to try and calculate the consequences? You might presumably start by looking at the legislation and interpreting the sanctions that are set out there. Well, there are no sanctions set out in the legislation. So then one wonders, well, what are the consequences of that sort of breach? A breach of that nature, had it occurred, would be judicially reviewable. So JR would be an option. But then what would the outcome of the judicial review be in sort of tangible terms? One would probably find the court would issue declaratory relief if there has unquestionably been a breach of the obligation to secure that emissions reduction target. But beyond that, it's very difficult to think what the courts could do in meaningful terms. You can't simply issue some sort of new age order to simply order that the Secretary of State will just go out and hit that target, because we're dealing with a complex economy-wide target. And that's really just scratching the surface of some of the novel legal issues that arise, in particular when we think about sanctions and enforceability in this novel context.
Yes, and you say that, in fact, that the Climate Change Act was not, as you say, intended to facilitate a narrow cash grab for private individuals who know how to work the legal system. It's not designed to cough up money. Just moving on to, you call the generation of heat and electricity the low-hanging fruit that bears the lion's share of emissions reductions. What else must we do you think?
Well, that's a very interesting question. And I think to answer it, it's useful to, again, start from the sort of nature, if you will, of this legislation, which is a framework regime that I've characterized as a sort of skeleton regime. It's a bit like a skeleton where you have these bones. It sets the policy direction, but the flesh that will be put on the bones, it's thought, will arise through secondary legislation and innovative action and policy and so forth and practical decisions. So while the framework itself sketches out a broad policy direction and does important things, the flesh that will go in those bones is a whole other question. And so when you look at how we've been, as a country, been trying to secure those emissions reduction targets and other things included within the Act, there's a five-year carbon budgeting scheme that rolls around. The UK has tended to rely on what I characterise as the low-hanging fruit of emissions reduction, namely, chiefly, electricity generation and heat. And one of the reasons that policy has focused on those areas in particular to secure initial leading-edge reductions under the regime is that they're an extremely abundant source of emissions, and they're frankly a little easier to tackle than certain other areas of the economy. So think, for example, of driving down emissions under power generation through the emissions trading scheme and stimulating a renewables rollout and energy efficiency and so forth, where you have a sort of tangible things occurring, practical measures. Think about that in comparison with reducing emissions from the agricultural sector, where you're dealing with complex biological cycles and so forth. I mean, they're not worlds apart, but they pose profoundly different problems. And so the low-hanging fruit, as it were, of electricity generation and heat, which provided easier avenues to make substantial inroads into initially, is not being exhausted as an area we need to target. But a point I was trying to make is that I'm suggesting and advocating that we really need to strategize and pushing that emissions reduction trajectory more deeply through society. And a key sector will be, and is, the government is moving on this, but one can always go farther, will be transport. That was not construed as a low-hanging fruit sector in my terms, if you like, whereas, you know, electricity and heat were, which are important. But so we're starting to move and really push the envelope in these newer areas, and that will become essential because, as we say, we have this downward ratcheting of emissions reductions. And when we get to 2050 or approach that time, it will likely be a real, real challenge to secure that target. And let's hope we do.
Dare I ask whether the lockdown will have the kind of effect on transport that you call for in your paper?
Well, there's a discourse in philosophy about there being two sides to every coin, that we maybe can't have the wonderful side of life without the tragic side of life. We sort of need good to mutually define bad. And I'm not a philosopher, but obviously the current lockdown is a challenging, you know, real tragic, worrying situation. On the other side of the coin, the positive side, which certainly doesn't outweigh all the terrible things that are going on, there are some very modest positive impacts. And one is that with the unfortunate slowdown of the economy and the concerns that brings and so forth, and people traveling less, and as we are locked down, as you say, at the current time, those influences are driving down emissions. One wouldn't want tragic circumstances to be relied on to secure a positive outcome under the Act, of course, because that would just be morally unthinkable. However, the fact that we are in this current phase has unquestionably had some positive impact on transport emissions and emissions indeed more broadly.
Well, yes. I mean, had we not been locked down, we would have all been driving to London to have this interview.
Very true.
As we're on the subject of transport, I'd like to bring David in here and ask you, David, about the Heathrow third runway decision, which you've written about in some detail on the UK Human Rights blog.
Yes, this was the decision by the Court of Appeal to grant a declaration that a particular government decision to proceed with the third runway at Heathrow was unlawful. The decision was reached on the 27th of February 2020, which seems an absolute age ago, but it is in fact quite recent. The decision in question was a national policy statement, which is a formal process under the Planning Act 2008. And what a national policy statement does is it sets the fundamental framework for the development. So it will say there should be a third runway at Heathrow rather than expanding Gatwick. It won't go down into the minutiae of how that third runway is built, and that will go through the more conventional planning process. But because it sets the fundamental policy, it's important to get it right. And in this case, the government got it rather badly wrong. And how did they get it wrong? Simply by making an error of law. The error of law was this. The Planning Act said that the national policy statement must take account of government policy relating to climate change. Now, the government had decided not to take into account the impact of the Paris Agreement. The Paris Agreement made in 2015, ratified by the government in 2016, and to which the government in Parliament has accepted that it is going to enshrine in domestic law. And it seems to have been a completely bizarre decision, because what happened was that the Secretary of State had received legal advice that not only did he not have to take the Paris Agreement into account, but that he was legally obliged not to take it into account at all. So he had to wipe it out of all his thinking, which, if one is examining a decision to enter into national policy statement in 2018, seems completely bizarre. And this was the very sort of pretty clean-edged legal decision which led to the declaration of unlawfulness being granted. The government seems to have got itself into a bit of a muddle due to the fact that the Paris Agreement was an international agreement, which was not formally part of English law. But that wasn't the question. The question was whether it was government policy, and government policy included the Paris Agreement. Now, that was obviously, has in practical terms, been the cause for the third runway proposal to go on hold until the government reaches a lawful decision about it. But there was a certain amount of hysteria in the press about the effects of this. People were frothing themselves up about it being those wretched judges poking their noses in again. But the Court of Appeal knew this was coming, and they made it fairly clear in the judgment that this was not what they were doing. The various passages. First is that all this means that no more than the executive must comply with the will of Parliament, as expressed in the terms of this section dealing with policy, section 5.8 of the Planning Act 2008. They said right at the end of the judgment, and again a bit that one hopes the leader writers might have read, this: we have not decided and could not decide that there will be no third runway at Heathrow. We have not found that a national policy statement supporting this project is necessarily incompatible with the UK's commitment to reduce carbon emissions under the Paris Agreement, or with any other policy the government may adopt or international obligations it may undertake. That is not the outcome here. So they're making absolutely plain that it's now for the government to do its job, to take into account the Paris Agreement. It doesn't have to slavishly follow the Paris Agreement, but at least to take it into account when it reaches its fresh decision. What the lockdown and all that will have on all this remains to be seen, because all of these decisions were based upon a whole series of predictions of increases in volumes, which inevitably will need reconsidering as and when we decide what our post-virus society is about.
Absolutely. And staying with transport and the economic effect of the lockdown, what about the HS2 business, David?
Yes, well, this fits absolutely perfectly into Thomas's category, the second big decision of the courts, much more recently in this case. This was some proceedings commenced as recently as the 27th of March 2020, decided on the 3rd of April, and for which written reasons were given on the 6th of April. The case was about Chris Packham seeking an injunction to stop HS2's contractors chopping down trees from ancient woodland in preparation for the HS2 project. The HS2 project, as we all know, has had a long history already, but the latest stage was a decision by Boris Johnson on the 11th of February, following a review of the whole proposal to proceed with the project. And he basically followed a report of a panel known as the Okavy Review. Here we are again in Paris Agreement territory. The majority in the report decided that the proposal was nearly carbon neutral. How on earth did it do that? Well, it started by trying to compute the amount of emissions to be caused by the construction phase, and it decided they were in the range of 8 to 14 million tonnes of CO2. It said that once the project had gone ahead, it foresaw savings of between 11 and 12 million tonnes over the first, and now wait for it, 60 years of the project. So it came up with this quite delicate balance between an immediate, fairly immediate construction phase, cost 8 to 14, and a saving of 11 to 12 over 60 years, and some bromides addressed at HS2 contractors saying, I dare say they can come up with some innovative ways of saving emissions as the project got built. So what then was the challenge? Well, Mr. Packham said that there had been various errors in the course of this process, and he sought this injunction. And the court was unconvinced by the various different ways in which this was said to be erroneous, the different ways in which there was a conclusion that it was close to carbon neutral, and therefore decided that the claim for an injunction was based upon unarguable grounds and therefore shouldn't be granted.
The government has recently made an important announcement regarding the construction of HS2.
Yes, it's given formal approval for the construction work on the project to begin despite lockdown measures. This means that work will proceed as fast as possible in circumstances where it might be thought that the rest of the country is suffering under significant constraints as to its opportunities of earning a living. The timing seems a little odd, to me at least, given the underlying timeline for both phases of this particular project. It is currently estimated that phase one, i.e. from London to Birmingham, will be completed in 2028 to 2031. And from phase two, which is north from Birmingham, both to Manchester and to Leeds, will be completed in 2035 to 2040. In those circumstances, it does seem very odd to signal proceeding with this project in circumstances where many, many people are suffering economically.
But just to wind things up and perhaps to get both your opinions on this, can I put to you a slightly contentious question, which is, will we be able to afford the luxury of the Climate Change Act and reducing our carbon emissions when we're trying to kickstart a very damaged economy? Thomas.
me first. I'm an optimist. I believe we can. I hope we can, and I believe we can. That's not to say that, as you rightly point out, Rosalind, or imply that it's a very grave and difficult situation economically, of course, at present and in going forward. I'm always mindful of the great crisis that is presented to global society by climate change, partly because I suppose as an academic lawyer, we partly have a luxury of reading more sources and policy reports and scientific papers than might normally be conventional when one is practicing. And when you go through that process with climate change, it really impresses upon you the problems and the concerns. And it's quite a nerve-jangling area of law actually to work on. And I very much hope that we can overcome these current challenges in the interest of climate mitigation and adaptation and going forward. I do think the Climate Change Act is a good basis for doing so. It's not perfect. And there are, I think, bumps we can probably anticipate in the road, and in fact could anticipate regardless of the current difficult circumstances. One concrete example is that we have 5 carbon budgets set at the current time. These are set roughly 12 years in advance under the terms of the Act, and they're set out in 5-year time blocks. We're currently in the 3rd carbon budget, which spans 2018 to 2022, and the overall reduction required in that budget is 37%. Now, the Committee on Climate Change, the expert advisory body set up under the Climate Change Act that advises government and the devolved administrations and so forth, had pointed out that we were going to have some serious problems in achieving the 4th and 5th carbon budgets, which span 2023 to 2027 and 2028 to 2032, as we're trying to work towards our 2050 target. Well, what we did since that advice was given was we amended the 2050 target from initial 80% figure to a net zero 100% figure. So it wasn't initially at 100% when the Act was passed. It was amended in 2019. And I think it was a wonderful amendment. Net zero is important, but it speaks to the themes of your question. If we were going to have a difficult time meeting the 4th and 5th carbon budgets when working towards an 80% marker for 2050, just think of the difficulties we can anticipate in hitting a net zero 100% target for 2050 that's now embedded in law. And when you factor in the economic circumstances you rightly point to, we realize we are in for a challenge. But as an optimist, I believe this can be done and the Climate Change Act can contribute usefully to that.
David, from a practicing lawyer's perspective, are you an optimist?
I'm an optimist, yes, I think I am. I'm not so convinced that the two projects which my cases were about, Heathrow 3 and HS2, fall into the absolutely essential category. And that's why I think we could possibly lose them without distorting the economy of the country too greatly. And there's a temptation to go with these big projects, some call them vanity projects, because they are so obvious and can be seen as a sign of a strong leader pushing ahead. But when one thinks that HS2 itself will contribute 0.1% of the whole UK's emissions in the period in which it's being built, one wonders whether there might be slightly better ways of seeking to kickstart the economy than pouring a lot of money into construction companies over the next 10, 15 years.
So I think we've pretty much covered the subject very thoroughly as far as we understand it at the moment, and who knows what the future has to bring. Thank you both very much for coming together to discuss it. And let's hope next time we talk, we can meet each other in the flesh.
Thank you.
Thank you.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.